Christmas is always a very convenient time of the year for everyone to be a little religious. The Christmas message preached to the world and for the world is always effective, and one to which I personally look forward to with annual anticipation. Perhaps if it wasn't for the world, the church would have already forgotten about the celebration of Christmas like Latter-day Pilgrims. We can look forward to such secular celebrations as Charlie Brown's Christmas, the Bing Crosby special, the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. We will not see Bob Hope this year as he is staying home in our nation. One of the more sentimental performances is the advertisement for Hallmark greeting cards that speaks about the birthday of the most influential person who has ever lived. His name is not mentioned, but the background of carols provide a subtle hint who it is. Regardless, the worldly Christmas is sometimes superior to that of the Christian virgin, where Christian preachers and theologians are explicit in the use of the name of Jesus, but are near totally agnostic about his existence or what he did. And so we are entering that portion of the year when we all get an opportunity to be a little religious. The season concludes with the New Year's ritual, the holiday of death and rebirth, of confession, of self-renewal, and self-determined regeneration. Changing the fourth digit on the calendar year is a striking reminder that we have all moved a little further away from the day of our birth and a little closer to the day of our death. Guy Lombardo, the high priest of us all, lifts his baton, New York, and the strains of old anxiety declare that another year has been washed away. If it is so that embarrassing transgressions cannot be forgiven with certainty, then they can at least be forgotten by minds appropriately dulled for the holiday. The world's Christmas is not without value, because it demonstrates that there is such a thing as secular decency. Paul had to remind the Christians that worldly ethical standards are frequently higher than those who are committed to a special revelation of God's law. And for law preaching, nothing can be more magnificent than Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, a kind of an Old Testament lesson for the world. Scrooge, a man of persistent uncharity, is haunted by the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. And even if the story is not Christian, old Scrooge at least is not a theologian of hope, a marked improvement over some Lutheran. Being soundly terrified by the chains of hell scraping against the stone pavement, Scrooge is converted to a good sound type of pharisaical hypocrisy and performs magnificent works of the law. So he can almost say with St. Paul that he was chief among the Pharisees. Dickens' story of Scrooge, which is misnamed the Christmas Carol instead it should be named The Last Judgment or Your Time Is Up or something like that, has value in teaching that man, in spite of the ravages of original sin, has sufficient moral sense to make him a halfway decent hypocrite. And for those who are a little more gospel-oriented rather than law-oriented, there's Clement Moore, The Night Before Christmas, whose chief character, Santa Claus, is slightly more appetizing than Scrooge, a man who makes all of us feel a little bit uncomfortable. And the story of Santa Claus is almost pure gospel, as it promises reward for good, but really no significant punishment for evil. With Scrooge, you will escape the evil if you do good. But with Santa Claus, you will receive rewards for your good deeds. A subtle but very important distinction. Scrooge is a story without heaven, but Santa is a story without hell. And that's why people go around at Christmas time dressed like Santa Claus and not like Scrooge, because they all like heaven better. Santa is so gospel-oriented, he doesn't have to scare people out of hell into heaven. He gently coaxes them. And central, as you know, to the Santa Claus religion is the reading of Towards the Night Before Christmas. The late apocryphal story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer can be substituted or sung as the chief hymn. It is a message of natural and infused grace, somewhat Augustinian. Even a total loser like Rudolph is not without some redeeming feature, like his nose. And the central parts of the religion can be found in the hymn also, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Here children are urged to keep their voices under control, to avoid naughty things, and to engage in charitable acts which their parents will notice. All this to produce little hypocrites for the season. And Santa receives only written petitions, as vocal prayers never seem to reach him. He has a degree of restricted omniscience and knows the good and evil acts of children, but not of adults. In the past, evil children were rewarded with pieces of coal in their stockings, but with the fuel crisis, this might be an encouragement for evil. These Christmas themes of New Year's, with its ceremony of death and rebirth, the legalism of a Scrooge, and the gentle gospel legalism of Santa Claus, are not without value. Regardless of motivation, they all stress good behavior and adherence to the law. And this is especially refreshing when the nation's lawmakers and the nation's law enforcers break the law themselves, and when those in the church proclaim antinomianism under the slogan of gospel freedom. Nevertheless, the God of this world, whether he is attired as a reborn New Year's baby or Santa Claus or Scrooge, is completely different from the God who was proclaimed by the prophet Isaiah. The secular Christmas God comes to his devotees with a mouth full of requirements, this do, and thou shalt live. And the God of Isaiah approaches his people with his gifts and his benefits that his people have tried to earn for themselves, but which they have continually failed to obtain. The Christmas message is, first of all, God's own realization, that man has been a total failure in trying to correct the situation which he has brought upon himself. And now God himself has decided to take our obligations upon himself. God does not come looking to see if man has done enough to earn his salvation, but God comes bringing his salvation with him. He comes magnificently, riding in the chariot of his own accomplishment. It is the right hand of the Lord alone that does valiantly, and nothing else. God comes to man riding furiously, and he permits nothing to stand in his way as he plows furiously forward to his goal. And running before God's chariot, the prophet Isaiah cries, "Clear the highway of stones and lift an ensign or a flag among the peoples." The chief story of the Old Testament, there is the story of God's never-ending hope in sorting out through the sons of men, looking for one individual who will be his servant in every sense of the word, the servant who will understand God's mind and God's will and shall carry God's plan through to completion. And after centuries of divine frustration, in which about 80% of the Hebrew population have disappeared through the Assyrian invasion captivity, the only hope for God is a few Jewish stragglers captive in Babylonia, They also seemed destined for national oblivion through ethnic integration and religious harmonization. In the desperateness of it all, God finally does what he knew all along he would have to do. He assumes the burden of the Jews and of all Gentiles to himself. And the servant who assumes this obligation is Yahweh, the Lord God of Sabaoth. It is he who comes and rescues his people. There is nothing religiously unique about the concept of God visiting people. This is one of the themes of both the Old and the New Testament, but it's not unique to the Bible. The American Indians, as you know, looked for the appearance of the white man God, and when they thought that this God appeared in the Spaniards, those Indians received the chains of enslavement. In the Hellenistic and Roman mythologies, the celestial beings enjoyed an occasional earthly weekend, a kind of a night out on the earth, and such overnighters were opportunities for the gods to give a few demonstrations of how great they were, and frequently just an opportunity for a little sport, fun, and games. But the God of the prophet Isaiah does not come to perform another act of power, so that in case we did not get to see the first creation, we will get an opportunity to see the second one. Christmas is not a demonstration of divine brute creative force. Christmas is this, that God comes to assume all human obligations to himself, and to demonstrate that he can successfully fulfill his own law and suffer his own punishment. For as the prophet Isaiah says, see, his reward is with him, and what he has earned goes in front of him. The only imperative for man is that he gets out of God's way to clear God's highway of stones. With God doing it all, nothing will be allowed to hinder God. In Isaiah chapter 40, there is a command from God to build for God a highway in the desert. Now, some scholars have offered the interpretation that the Jews were hoping for some type of divine interstate right through the middle of the desert. Now, only a demented Gentile scholar following that silly exegesis would suggest that the words build up in the highway, cleared of stones, that God, again, is interested in building a modern elevated highway, something like the Pulaski Skyway that lifts itself gloriously high over the New Jersey swamp. The only command to man is this, is that he stand out of God's way. Don't put any obstacles in the path of God as he travels dreadfully fast to the aid of his people. The message of Christmas, secular or Christian, is one of reward and punishment. The theme of Santa Claus and Scrooge is good people get rewarded nicely and evil people get punished. And the Christmas message of Isaiah is exactly the same. But according to Isaiah, it is God's righteous servant who is punished in our place, so that God can bring rewards to his people. There must have been some rhyme or reason in the way the editor composed the third part of the Isaiah scroll. He must have done more than shuffle the servant songs together like a deck of cards. The message to Zion of its salvation, that they are God's holy people, redeemed of the Lord, no longer forsaken, no longer forgotten, is possible only because God himself has trampled in the vineyard of man's sin all by himself. Israel is redeemed because God has paid the payment with his own lifeblood. The blood in his garment is the evidence of how he paid the price. And we do not have to be reminded that the blood on his garment is the same blood that fills the chalice of his holy supper. Salvation and redemption of God are not just another Christmas present. Christmas is not just the birth of the world's most significant personality. Christmas is the message of the thundering approach of God, who is roaring around the corners of man's existence with sparks flying from the wheels of his holy chariot. And God is literally armed to the teeth with everything which he has done for man's redemption. Christmas is, for all practical purposes, a one-man show. And that one man is not Scrooge, or Santa Claus, or Bob Hope, or Bing Crosby, or you. Certainly it's not me. And it's certainly not all pious Christians put together with all their good works in one magnificent pile. Christmas is the story of what one man did. And that one man is Jesus Christ, who is both Isaiah's God and the suffering servant.